York. I'm sorry for coming here late, so I hadn't really picked up on the sort of emotional timber of this meeting, and I'm not sure who is who and what's going on. But I will try to give a talk that will be of general interest, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about basic biology. You'll see that it crosses over at some stages, definitely touches on the things that you just heard from Dan. So I'm going to focus for the first 90% of this talk on the question of polarity rather than direction finding. And so the question is, how do cells make polar structures? And the simple answer is that they stick out a nose in one direction and they have a rear in the other that they bring forward, and that's polarity. But the way things we need to explain are several. So one of them is, this image on the left is going to be a movie, and that is a cell that's expressing this pH domain of AKT that binds PIP3. And what you see is that in the basal state, this cell has that probe all over it in its cytoplasm because there isn't much PIP3 in the membrane. So it's all over, the probe is. It's going to go to the membrane. Here it's going to go to the membrane when the cell is put in a uniform concentration of attractant, no gradient at all, and watch what happens. What you see is first PIP3 appears in the membrane everywhere, and then it gradually gets to be much more at one part of it than the other. The cell polarizes. The other cell polarized in the opposite direction. There must be a button here. This one went this way, this one went this way. But in both, yeah, Boris?
How did this thing get started?
It got started by adding, there was no attractant there, and you added attractant everywhere. Okay? So uniform attractant. So the first question we want to deal with is, how does attractant take a cell that is fundamentally resting and has no polarity and make it into a polar structure? The second question is, when cells are following a pipette, if you look at neutrophils, you'll find this is not true of all Dicti, but true of all neutrophils, it's the front of the cell that follows the pipette, and the back acts as a sort of a passive partner. So, if I can get this guy to go, yes, watch. So what you see is these fronts are following this pipette. This is the one that I say reminds me of my adolescent life chasing something else, because it never catches it. It's enormously frustrated. Its success is very similar to what my success was as an adolescent. But the point is that it's the nose that's following it. The rest of it follows. So the nose is what's sensitive. Furthermore, if Sally Zygmunt showed 20 years ago that if a cell is in a very shallow gradient, say going in this direction, and the cell is walking in this direction, a gradient such that the front of the cell is only seeing 2% more attractant than the back, and at about this point here, the gradient was changed to being 2% the other way, what the cell does instead of backing up is to do a U-turn. So we saw U-turns here, U-turns here, and we've got polarity here. So we need to explain why the front is more sensitive to movements, to changes in the gradient, which is, yeah.
In your first image, how stable is that polarity?
That polarity is extremely stable once it's set for a good 8 minutes or so. We don't know beyond that. But it's stable a good long time. And the cells move semi-straight. They definitely turn, but they hardly ever turn right back around. Although occasionally they will turn immediately right when the attractant just hit them. They'll polarize and seem to go this way and then decide to go another way. But then they tend to go in one direction for a long time.
I think the question, I guess yeah. What he's trying to ask is, does it then subsequently always retain that precise location as the pole? Or can it subsequently acquire?
Okay, that's something that Sally Zygmunt did, and we've done a little bit of. As long as it's in the same concentration of attractant, it'll just keep on going. But what Sally did was take attractant away. Then what you see is the cell becomes round again, and now you add attractant back. If you add the attractant back at the same very soon after you've taken it away. You still have a round cell. It looks like a normal round cell, but it'll polarize in exactly the direction it was in. So it has a memory then. On the other hand, if you wait 10 minutes and add the attractant, now the direction in which it polarizes is completely random with respect to its first. So it has lost the memory. It's disappeared. And I'm going to tell you what the memory is. The memory is essentially not so much knowing where the front is, but the back has a longer decay time in it, is what we think is actually going on. So, yes. Well, it's not very precisely defined, certainly not by our experiments, and hers is just, it's a comment in a paper, basically, so it's not been done carefully. But it looks like it's of the order of a couple of minutes, and beyond that it fades away. So 10 minutes, it's certainly gone.
So we look at it in the mouse neutrophil, in a uniform, so they can last around like 10, 15 minutes. After that, you don't detect this kind of polarization. Whether they're going to come back again,
Yeah, I mean, that's the question of, you know, how long, what must be happening is that there's a structure persisting, and I think what we know what the structure is, but I'm not going to show any data on that, and the structure is the back is persisting. It's the actin-myosin ring, the parallel actin-myosin complex is parallel to the membrane that are contractile. They take longer to break down than the front does. The front is extremely labile. And we'll talk about that. That's why the front actually is able to turn so rapidly. So the answer to all these questions is something I'm going to call self-organizing properties of the actin-myosin cytoskeleton. Now, I was told by a physicist friend that self-organizing means a lot of things to physicists that have almost nothing to do with what I'm going to use it to mean. So I should define that, okay? And you can call it Fred or Joe or Frank or whatever it is, but I'm going to call it self-organizing. And what I mean by this is the way biologists have been talking about it. Self-organizing systems, there are a number of examples. One of them is morphologic polarity, where a cell gets a front and a back. And many, many, many cells and organisms, and of course all of us as developed organisms have polarity as well. Regulation of cell, of organism size, is actually very precisely controlled and in a very interesting way. If you make an animal that has cells with four times the normal amount of DNA, the cells are four times as big, but the animal is exactly the same size. That is an astonishing finding. And what it means is that there's some way that the thing is organized that says you're only going to have a kidney that big, and you're only going to have a lung that's that big, et cetera, et cetera, even if the cells are very much larger. So there's some kind of self-organizing regulation that keeps it that way. Patterning in development is usually self-organization, and the properties of it are that it's a phenomenon that requires usually continuing input of energy and of materials to keep it going. There are two or even more states of the components in their relation to one another. The transitions can be relatively rapid so that it's possible to lose one state fairly rapidly and take on another one. And it's possible to induce collapse of this of some robust dynamic system in which lots of things are happening into one that has a stable phenotype or a different stable phenotype depending on some regulatory phenomenon that has occurred. So. And that's what I'm going to mean by self-organizing. It's a little bit vague. You can think of it as a more complex version of self-assembly. It's not just self-assembly where you have parts that are sort of hanging around and you can only put this one on if you put the first one on. But it's somewhat akin to it. So now an example of a self-organizing actin-myosin cytoskeleton is in a lovely experiment that was done by Gary Boris's lab, in which they took fish keratocytes, which are the champion crawlers in vertebrate cells, and they poisoned the myosin reversibly, and they got the cells pieces of the cells would crawl off and make these little tiny cytoplasts that had no mitochondria, no microtubules, and were perfectly round and just sitting on the dish. If you magnify it, it looks like this. It has cortical actin that is radially distributed, pointing out in every direction all the way around it, and it just sits there. If another cell, they noticed if another cytoplasm was walking along and banged into it, then it would start crawling. So what they did was to take a pipette, and in this case the pipette has zero attractant in it, it's exactly the same medium as here, and just apply a little transient pressure to one side. And when they do that, the cell undergoes goes into a different organization. It becomes shaped rather like the parent fish keratocyte, and crawls off long after the pressure, the little pressure on its membrane has gone away. And we can talk about how that occurred. They actually studied what was really going on here. It looks as if what happens is that the cell, when you press here, the radially directed actin fibers get sort of crushed into being parallel to the membrane, and as a result, myosin now walking along those actin fibers will cause contractility, which is what you get here.
And
no, they take the myosin poison away. That's really important. And then the reason the front becomes polymerized actin pointing out in this direction is that what you've done is to reduce by the volume of the cell is constant. You put a little pressure here. And now what you've done is to reduce the tension on this membrane that's pressing against the actin fibers. And when you do that, actin fibers are able to polymerize much faster. This is the theory, and there's some evidence for it in their paper. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but the point is you can go from a round thing that's sitting there to a cell that's crescent-shaped, that's crawling in one direction, and keeps on doing so long after you've put in any input at all.
It's just a pity, because understanding how cells move would be rather nice. Does the forceful movement come from that actinomyosin of the red?
The force movement, you can get 50 people to give you 50 different answers. Most people think that most of the force is from the actin polymerizing and pushing it out. I think that it's from both, and that actually neither by itself is quite enough. But I don't know that. I mean, you know, and certainly this is not my field.
You mean in acute keratocytes, or
are you
talking about the force in the keratocytes?
Yeah, in the keratocytes. I mean,
I was curious, what complaint did you get from physicists? Because this is sort of the same way physicists would use the word cell.
Well, it's not a physicist. It's actually a guy named Adam Arkin, who I know you know. And he told me this is absolutely full of shit, that there is a term for this. I can't remember what it is, but this is not the right term.
Self-organizing is not a technical term in physics. It's used, I think, by people.
You mean things sort of as vaguely as this?
Exactly the sense.
Yeah. But it's not a technical
term. I think its usefulness is that it is not so very precise. Yeah. If we got enormously precise, we'd be wrong. So now I'm going to give you the punchline of the first 90% of this talk, which is how this self-organizing actin-myosin assemblies, actin and actin-myosin assemblies, allow polarity to occur. And the answer is that an attractant binds to a receptor and in neutrophils stimulates two separate pathways. One is through a G protein called GI that stimulates frontness. And the other one is through some other G protein or some other protein, but it's not through GI, and it stimulates backness. And what frontness is essentially de novo polymerization of actin. And there's a positive feedback loop in this. PIP3 is here, and RAC are involved in a positive feedback loop by which actin polymers pressing out on the membrane beget more actin polymers because they stimulate accumulation of PIP3 and more activation of RAC. And so that's why the front is able to be localized where it is. On the other hand, the cell at the back has got, through a different set of small GTPases and signals, most of which are undefined, has activated contraction of actin and myosin, which does several things. One is it contracts the back, pressing everything forward, and it also helps the cell to de-adhere from its substrate. These two have to oppose one another in the sense that it's not possible for any one square nanometer of the surface to be both protruding actin and contracting. They are mutually exclusive. And the reason you get polarity is that when you stimulate both of them, they segregate themselves into separate parts of the cell membrane. Yeah?
Why do you feel that, in fact, the cells of contraction involve pushing forward?
I don't have any. I'll tell you about that later. That's not part of this talk because the evidence is weak in the extreme, but I'll be glad to talk with you about it sometime. Why do people feel it's involved in pushing it forward?
Yeah.
Oh, because when you paralyze it, it doesn't push forward. It's basically...
I mean, they drag their butt. Is the difference between the contractility that might be involved in lifting or removing, you know, substratum interaction versus the actual pushing?
I can't answer you that from data that we've got. I really can't.
I think it's a much more plausible mechanism for pseudoplasmic extension, that is contraction
to that.
No,
but I thought
static
cradle.
You don't need contraction.
Yeah,
you
certainly do.
How can the actin push?
I thought, Rick, actually, in
myosin cells that lack myosin, which have no contractility, they move forward fine.
No, what they do though is they tend to move to the side a lot.
Well,
they don't.
That's
yeah. Okay, and also, but those are...
They're dicky, there are myosin null cells that still manage to move, right?
Okay, wait a minute. We'll get to dicky in a moment. I have a slide on dicky, and I will point out to you why they don't need their myosin, because they don't do the polarity thing in the same way.
Okay?
Neutrophils have been honed by evolution to be spectacularly good at pointing and charging off. Dicty crawls around, but it doesn't have a formal front unless it's a one of these older dicty or something at a later developmental stage, and then they get very nicely polar. But you'll see a movie of that later. And so myosin isn't as important for the polarity there. The model system is one you've already heard about, and that is HL60 cells. Guy Servan in the lab worked out a way of transfecting them and differentiating them so we get neutrophils that look like real neutrophils. Yeah?
The
studies were done maybe 15 years or so ago in which it looked as if the volume, at least over short times, was pretty carefully conserved. It looks like the cell is getting a whole lot bigger, but what's happening is it's actually reaching out thin sheets around it, is right?
So the contraction, the bag can increase the pressure inside of the
bag. Right, right. Now, there one school of thought says that what that contraction does is to just relieve some tension that's pressing against the actin polymers at the front and allow them to grow faster. Another says that it's actually pushing the cell forward. And we've got very, very weak experiments that I'm not going to talk about that say that that's more important than I thought it was before, but we don't know that. I just want you all to see this. I don't know whether Dan showed this movie or not. This is the famous 1950s movie in which the cell is chasing a Staph aureus. And the reason I want to show it is that I want you to see that it's the front of this cell that is plastic, that can rapidly move around. The back is just along for the ride. There it eats it and goes into a postprandial torpor. Okay, so the membrane signals, you've already been through this and I won't spend much time on it, but when we started in this field, it looked as if there was a pertussis toxin sensitive G protein, GI, that activated PI3 kinases, PIP3 accumulation somehow activated GEFs that activated RhoGTPases, and you got actin assemblies at the front. And it wasn't clear what was happening at the back. But somehow that also was a consequence of the attractant hitting the receptor. And so you've heard about RhoGTPases. There's a mixture of them. I can spend a long time on this, but basically the three flavors We're going to talk about all three flavors, but in the first part of the talk, we're going to only talk about these two. This one in fibroblasts, when it's activated, causes formation of contractile actin-myosin cables that connect in fibroblasts that connect focal adhesions that are bound to the substrate. This one, RAC, activates polymerization of actin and formation of actin-containing ruffles that stick out from the cell surface. And CDC42, when it's activated in fibroblasts, causes formation of filopodia, in which actin is polymerized, but in a rather different conformation from here. So we're going to the point that I'm making here is, I'm summarizing again, the attractant working through PIP3 RAC and RAC is activating actin polymerization. That's going to be increasing the sensitivity of the system, and therefore the more PIP3 it will be produced in response to the attractant. And that's why the front is sensitive to the attractant and the back is not, that is, at least with respect to being able to move towards it. The front is sensitive, the back is not, and in a sense you can say that the cell then is building up a huge gradient of signal within itself compared to zero gradient if you just put in uniform attractant, or even a shallow gradient that's outside. We'll talk about what happens at the back later, which I'm going to show you is rho and myosin dependent. The front then is going to be PIP3, RAC, actin, and increased sensitivity here, and the back is going to be rho and downstream activation of myosin contraction. Yeah?
One thing I still don't know is how do you break the symmetry when you build that uniform?
Well, we'll come to that, but I'll give you the short answer, which is we don't know. But what the guess is that what happens is the positive feedback loop means that if you've got a little bit of actin polymerization, you're going to get more.
A little random effect is something like that.
Yes, but they have to segregate from one another because they're mutually incompatible. And it's useful, I think, under the modelers will have to help me with this, but the fact that the signal diverges here, one part of the signal going to the front and the other one going to the back, makes it possible then to be banging both these horses at once, and they just are both of them being simulated, but they can't both occur in the same part of the membrane. So they have to collect into sections, one domain that's going to be like this and one like this. Yeah. That's a subject of vast controversy, depending on the receptor in the laboratory. When we started in this, we found 7 papers, 3 of which said the receptors were mostly at the front, 3 said they were at the back, and 1 said that they were connected. They were collected in the middle. And so what we did was to put in GFP-tagged C5a receptors into PLB985 cells, and when the cells went towards C5A, the receptor was exactly the same distribution as a membrane, fluorescent membrane probe. So we couldn't tell the difference. I think it's probably not, and in Dicti, it looks as if it's not distributed abnormally either. Although it's behaving differently at the front and the back, the actual amount of receptors is not different. Yeah?
I mean, the way you're describing it, there's this all happens by some random event in one place, which then, let's say, gets the front started, and then there has to be some really cooperative action involving the whole cell. It would seem to me that one might ask, in sort of contemporary terms, why there isn't a new front opened in the East.
And there is, but in the normal cell, that front will be quenched, because it turns out to be more efficient to have squeezing all going in one direction and protrusion all going in one direction. And you'll see movies, we can make there be multiple fronts. We can produce them. I promise you, you'll see that. That's what happens when you can't make a rear end. Okay, so now, I'm not going to show the data for this. Orion Weiner showed that there is a PIP3 based positive feedback, which we had suspected on other grounds, simply by showing that if he added PIP3 in a uniform concentration to cells, he got polarity, he got PHAKT all going to the front. The cells crawled beautifully and kept on crawling. And that was completely blocked if he inhibited endogenous PIP3 production, or if he inhibited the RhoGTPases. So the endogenous PIP3 production was necessary to respond to PIP3 that he put in exogenously. And so we decided then that there was a positive feedback loop in which ordinarily the receptor could initiate it, but then it would feed on itself to keep the front going. Now we're going to talk about RAC at the front, and these three people did most of these work. Here what we've done is, if you look here, a dominant negative RAC produces a cell that doesn't polarize like this. Here's actin, here's PHAKT, here's the overlay of a normal cell. A RAC N17 expressing cell, you get very little actin, very little PHAKT recruitment to the membrane. And in fact, if you here's that movie that I showed you of a control cell, which is polarizing, PIP3 everywhere, then PIP3, look here, see it's several places, and then it goes to one place, and the cell crawls off. Now, if you look at a RAC M17 expressing cell, it's extraordinarily boring. You put on attractant, and virtually nothing happens. The cell just sort of sits there. It doesn't accumulate PIP3 in the membrane, and it doesn't protrude anyway.
So the answer to my question in this control was that if it does, it begins to
one wins.
But it then gets
right. Right. And in fact, when we look carefully at normal cells, if you catch them during the process, catch them early, and stain, probably 5%, and on some days even 10% of them will show two fronts. But then if you look later, at 5 minutes, that's a very, very much smaller percentage that show two fronts. So now, if you...
Have you looked on dominant negative RAC activation of AKT? At least in our cells, there's no... I mean, we see the same phenotypic effect with respect to actin, but there's no impairment on AKT activation with dominant negative RAC.
We haven't been able to do that because we can't get more than a small fraction of the cells transfected. So we could, in fact, put in a tagged AKT that we immunoprecipitated and looked for phosphorylation. We could certainly do that. We haven't done that. So here's an experiment that just shows the positive feedback loop initiated at the level of RAC. If what we do is we add... I'm not showing that yet, but what I'm going to show you is that if you add a RAC V12, which is constitutively active to cells, no attractant whatever, what happens is that PHAKT accumulates in membranes, actin polymerizes. It doesn't polymerize in a polarized fashion. It's everywhere, and the reason it doesn't polymerize in a polarized fashion is presumably that the activated RAC is everywhere and it can't do it. But the RAC is stimulating PIP3 accumulation. So it turns out that part of this feedback loop is mediated by the actin itself, whose polymerization is initiated and is triggered by RAC. And the evidence for that is that if we soak up actin monomers and prevent polymerization, we reduce the feedback. We make it unstable and reduce its amount. So here are cells that have been treated with latrunculin. You see there are no actin polymers. They're completely round. If you add uniform attractant, you get the PIP3 probe going to membranes briefly, and then it goes back to the cytoplasm. Whereas here's a cell, this is I think 8 minutes after treatment, and you see the PIP3 is still vigorously at the front. So we think it reduces the steepness of the PIP3 gradient, although it definitely allows there to be a gradient if you have a pipette there. And latrunculin inhibits phosphorylation of AKT as well. Now, it also blocks the PHAKT response to RAKV12. So here is a cell that's expressing RAKV12, and you see PHAKT is at the membrane in this cell. And now latrunculin is added to it. Here's 20 seconds, 120, and 240 seconds. And what you see is that the PHAKT has already begun to leave the membrane here, and eventually there's virtually none of it in the membrane. So when you turned off actin polymerization, you lose the PIP3 that is actually being stimulated by the actin polymers that are triggered by RAK. Now, yeah.
Experiment
and lose, since you have a chunk and you lose the ability to polarize
whatsoever, there's no feedback. Right, that's the point of this. Right, there's no
feedback. What do you mean? Well, there wasn't any polarization to begin with here, right? There's no attractant here. This is just activated RAK. So there's no polarity. This cell doesn't have a polarity. It doesn't have a front and a back. It's just got, if we were to stain for actin, we'd find actin all the way around it, and PIP3 is all the way around it. So there's no polarity. It's just, but you don't really have positive feedback. What you're doing here is you're just harnessing the positive feedback mechanism by banging on it all over the cell very hard at one of its nodes. Yeah.
Does this mean that actin polymerization is an integral part of the positive feedback loop? Or
yes.
Or it just be that when you add the latrunculin, you somehow alter the parameters?
Well, that's a good question. So the question is actin responsible for all of the feedback? And the answer is no. And that's actually what this shows. That is to say, if instead, latrunculin does allow PIP3 to accumulate at the upgradient face of cells that can't polymerize actin. Okay, and that's been shown very nicely in Dicti as well. So the cell can accumulate PIP3, whereas if we inhibit the Rho GTPases, which in theory shouldn't do anything it should do the same thing to actin polymerization, although by a different mechanism. Now we get no recruitment of PHAKT to the membrane, so no PIP3 is made. So C. difficile toxin does that. That inhibits all three of them, and a toxin called lethal toxin that inhibits only RAK and CDC42 does exactly the same thing. So what we think then is that there probably are sort of two feedback loops. In one of them may be being some Rho GTPase directly feeding back to accumulate PIP3 in some way, and then that effect is augmented by an extra loop that is latrunculin sensitive and that is dependent on actin polymerization.
Maybe I can be a little more precise in my question. What I'm saying is, it is possible, for instance, and this is just a hypothesis, that for instance, when you add latrunculin and you mess up the polymerization, then the lack, or if you will, the accumulation of G-actin may have some positive, a negative feedback effect on the existing positive feedback loop, which messes up the positive feedback loop completely and ruins its ability to create the polarization. In other words, what I'm saying is that it's not an integral part of the positive feedback loop. All it does is have some influence on the parameters of the prevailing positive feedback loop, which ruins its ability to perform.
Yeah, and I think that
these are two equally plausible scenarios.
Yeah, but the result is exactly the same.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that they operationally differ. That is to say, in every case, if you make more actin polymers, you're going to get more PIP3. You activate RAK, you're going to get more PIP3. And so the function of it is that operationally, actin and PIP3 both increase the concentration of one another. You with me? Polymerized actin and PIP3 do that. Yeah.
So PI3K gamma, at least what's been shown biochemically, is two inputs. One is RAS, and the other input is beta gamma signaling. So where do you envision the Roche GTPases in mediating the activation of PI3 kinase? Because presumably you're either blocking its mobilization or its association with the membrane, or you're blocking its ability to be activated. So it has to either affect the beta gamma, somehow affect the beta gamma subunit, or somehow affect RAS activation, unless there's another mechanism, right?
Yeah. And we know it's not RAS because dominant negative RAS in our hands does nothing whatever to this. The cells behave as if nothing had happened to them.
Dominant negative RAS?
RAS, right. So isn't that surprising? Knocks your socks off.
If it requires the activation of PI3K.
Well, but I don't think RAS is required to activate PI3K gamma. Beta gamma will do it all by itself. Now, the question though is how, if PI3K kinase gamma is the only PI3 kinase in the world, how is it that you get more PIP3 in a RAC and actin dependent way, right? And so there's several answers to that. One possibility is that the RAC, that what you're doing is maybe excluding PIP3 phosphatases from the front. You're not actually doing anything to increase synthesis, you're just decreasing degradation there. That's one possibility, and that's something that would fit with DICTI, although we don't find that kind of thing in these cells with P10 probes. That doesn't mean it's not happening. Another possibility is that there actually is more than one PI3 kinase species that is involved, and in fact we're having you've heard about a PI3 kinase gamma knockout, but in fact there are drugs that are said to inhibit PI3 kinase delta, which are said to inhibit directionality in neutrophils in a published paper. I was going to ask you what you thought of that one. We have used those inhibitors, and we don't see that in HL60 cells, so we imagine that those people have made it up, but I don't know. On the other hand, it could well be the case that PI3 kinase alpha or beta is augmenting the effect of PI3 kinase gamma. And what you imagine is, if there's a positive feedback, it's not a perfect positive feedback in which it can maintain itself forever. You have to keep on tickling it by activating beta gamma. And we know, for instance, if you take the attractant away, the PIP3 immediately disappears.
So yeah. We never really look at where the PI3K gamma is really look like. Maybe the actin polymerization will concentrate the PI3K gamma.
Yeah, it could make the membranes want to bind PI3 kinase gamma better, or make it harder to get the PI3 kinase gamma off, or any damn thing. We have to be agnostic about that. So now I want to turn, unless there are questions, to talking about the back of the cell. So here, the argument is going to be that the attractant stimulates a separate pathway that activates Rho, and that Rho then activates actin-myosin assembly, as you'll see, through an enzyme called ROC. And the trailing edge contracts and deadheres. It had been shown by many labs before that there's really an actin-myosin sort of carapace that's contracting all the way around the back and sides of a neutrophil. And it was suspected, and there were some experiments using pharmacologic inhibitors, that this was Rho dependent and dependent on ROC, which is a kinase that is downstream of Rho and which is known to cause activation of myosin light chain kinase. And inhibit inactivation of myosin light chains. So Here is an experiment that was triggered by work in Rick's lab and Peter Devriotti's lab. They showed, has Rick given his talk yet? I can't.
No.
Okay, well, what Rick will show, I think, is that in Dicti, the back of the cell has P10 on the membranes, the front does not. And we wanted to see that. P10 is a phosphatase that degrades PIP3. It would be lovely if that were the case in neutrophils. So here we expressed CFP P10 with plain YFP and overlaid them, and we couldn't see any localization. And it wasn't because the P10 didn't work. If we actually hooked the P10 to the membrane with the myristate attachment so that it was everywhere, now when we treat with attractant, we get nothing but backness. That is, we get myosin, activation of myosin, but we don't get any fronts at all. So, and we don't get any PIP3 at all. So that P10 is capable of doing it, but it's not detectably localized there. Now, as I'm sure you all realize, that doesn't mean it's not localized there. It means we didn't detect its localization there. But that's just the way it is. On the other hand, rho is at the back, whereas actin is at the front. And this is whether you use rho GFP or you use, this is an antibody to rho A. And myosin is at the back. And that had been shown before, but I think it's not been shown in movies. This is a myosin, a heavy chain GFP. And what you see is it's at the back of the cell in this sort of contractile arrangement around the membrane. So that was already known before, but it's nice to confirm it, and it's a measure of backness that we can do. So now, what we then did was to put in dominant positive and dominant negative versions of these things, or drugs, to see what happened. If you express transiently in some fraction of the cells a dominant positive rho that's always on, and then add attractant, here's a cell that didn't get rho, and you can tell it because it's not green, and it's got nice actin. Here's one that's got nice actin as well. Here is a cell that got dominant positive rho, no polymerization of actin, so it's all back. I showed you the control before, I won't show that again, but here's a cell that is expressing dominant positive rho, and what you'll see is an abortive front. This is the only one out of 15 that we looked at that showed this. There's a little transient attempt, but then it recedes and disappears. This is a cell that needs Viagra in the worst kind of way. Now, dominant positive ROC does exactly the same thing as dominant positive rho, and a myosin light chain that's got aspartates where the phosphates would be and is therefore constitutively active does exactly the same thing as well. So myosin, ROC, or rho, if they're activated everywhere, will prevent frontness, actin polymerization, and formation of a front. Now, on the other hand, if we inhibit ROC, or rho, or myosin 2 with an inhibitor called blebbistatin, which is quite specific and just published, I think, in Science by Strait and Mitchison, and they gave us some of this stuff. What you see is this is the case of a cell that can't form a firm back, and so it forms multiple fronts. So in this case, what we've got is runaway actin polymerization that's not opposed well by myosin. So let's just going to show you a couple of these because they're a little on the repetitive side. So now attractant is added to zero time, and what you see is this cell is deeply schizophrenic and is going to be in bad trouble. And if you wait with time, you actually get cytoplasts out of this, not surprisingly. Now here is a myosin inhibitor, which does essentially the same thing. And again, you have PIP3 at these fronts, but you have the multiple fronts, and if you let this go on, the cells will separate into pieces. So you need to be able to form a back in order to have one front. Right? Now, if you look for phosphorylated myosin with an antibody to phosphomyosin light chain, what you find is it's in the back. Here's actin, here's the back, that's where the phosphomycin is. If you use the ROCK inhibitor, which inhibits the effects of Rho, what you get is a cell that has multiple fronts with actin in every one of them, but you don't see any phosphomycin with the antibody. And we did this, and somebody was asking this question, we looked at many, many cells, and we did it in a blinded fashion where the person who was trying to read the phosphomycin didn't know what the treatments were, or even whether there was an antiphosphomycin antibody present. And it really looks like it's real. Now, the last point I want to make on BACness has to do with the fact that the BAC is insensitive to stimulation. Sally Zygmunt reported in the 1980s that neutrophils would follow a pipette, but if the pipette was put directly behind a polarized neutrophil, that in some proportion of the cases, I think she, about 25% in her experiments, and actually 65% in ours, if you put the pipette at the back, the cell forgets how to do anything, it collapses. And if you wait another 3 or 4 minutes, it will then polarize in that direction, but it takes quite a while to do so. So here is another one of these frustrated cells. You see it crawling toward the pipette. You see when it turns, it does a U-turn. The side of that front is what turns. So watch this. Same way here, the side of the front turns, comes down here, and now it's going to go a little farther, and now it's going to go to the back. And what the cell does is to fold up its tent and forget about it. And this happened, I think we looked at 10 cells. It happened in 6 of them. Now, in contrast, yes?
Is that supposed to be very dimensional?
Excuse me?
It was very high up, so it could turn over this way instead of that way.
Well, we can, if we lift the pipette up, we can get, you can get the front to look like it's sort of reaching up. We've never had them do a somersault. So that is, we may have seen it, but we didn't know we were seeing it. And I don't think this cell is trying to do a somersault, or if it does, it gets caught in midair and simply can't do anything. My guess is that what's happened is that the sensitive part of that cell was the pseudopod, and what you've now done is to take attractant away from that, put it at the back, and now the two sides of the pseudopod, of the old pseudopod, the pseudopod collapses. Its two sides remain a little bit sensitive, but they're receiving essentially the same amount of stimulus, and it can't really generate enough oomph to go one direction or the other. Whereas if you put it at the side, all you're really doing is taking actin polymers and a pseudopod that's already there and just redirecting it by giving a little bit more stimulation to one side of it than the other. Now, if on the other hand, you've inhibited ROCK and you use a pipette, yes?
Do you have any, what happens to, let's say, markers when you do a similar experiment?
Well, in this case, we know that the PIP3 disappears, in this case here. And we also know the same thing happens if you take the attractant away. So the actin collapses, the PIP3 disappears, and that occurs within 15, 20 seconds or so, right? I mean, it really is quick. So there's whatever is going on, the process has a fast breakdown rate, and that's why you continue to need attractant. Keep it going.
That's what I'm saying. So these are all morphological pictures, right?
Right, right.
But you can also visualize movements of pH domains.
Right. And when you do that, the pH domain would go back to the cytoplasm in this case. Now, here, if I can ever get the cursor, what you see is this cell is going towards the pipette up here. You saw that front. Now you put the pipette down here, and the back of it immediately goes towards it, and you get the same thing happening here. So when there is no firm back, now the cell, instead of doing U-turns, just starts going the other way. And that's what lots of Dicti films show, and I'll show you one of those in a minute.
What happens if you had not inhibited it by ROCK?
No, it would not. That's the point. Over here, we didn't inhibit ROCK. Here you're inhibiting ROCK, and we found exactly the same thing if we inhibit Rho or if we inhibit myosin, you get the same phenotype.
So on the left, what happens, as far as I can tell, is that polarity completely breaks down.
No, I don't think it breaks down. I think on this, in this case, when it got to the end there, you still had a back. It's just that the front disappeared. And if you were to take, and that is exactly, in many ways, equivalent to just taking the attractant away. This is these experiments we were talking about, reversibility. If you take the attractant away, the backness persists a little while. Frontness disappears very rapidly. Backness persists, so that now when you add attractant back, uniform attractant, you get a front in exactly the same place. You with me? So you haven't lost polarity altogether, you've lost a piece of it, the most prominent and obvious part of it, which is that actin pseudopod that's sticking out. But you've sort of, you've certainly made the cell so it doesn't behave normally. So now the point that I want to I'm going to actually now show you some pull downs for activities of enzymes, is that these two cytoskeletal assemblies are opposing one another, and they don't just oppose one another in a topographical way, that is, that you can have either protrusion or contraction and not both in the same square nanometer of cell surface. They also oppose one another's signaling pathways. And so the way that works is, it looks as if the front is controlled in this way, the back in this way, they're opposing one another. In the basal state, we think frontness is weak, but it's a little bit stronger than backness, and I'll show you why. Because when we take away frontness, we get a good activation of backness, so it's inhibiting it. They're mutually inhibitory here, and this one is pertussis toxin sensitive. This one is not, and therefore it's probably another G protein. We don't know which G protein. And the assays that we're going to use to assess them now are not morphological, but a GTP-bound RAC pull-down or phosphorylation of AKT. In this case, GTP-bound Rho. So first now, this is using the target of PIP3 that is activated by PIP3, and what you see is that attractant increases its activity markedly, that effect is completely blocked by pertussis toxin, 100% blocked in our experiments, and these are replicates. We did four and then we did another two, and it really replicates itself very nicely. Inhibition with an inhibitor of PI3 kinase almost completely inhibits activation. This is a one inhibitor. And treatment of the cells with latrunculin B, which soaks up actin monomers, partially inhibits. So part of this, the stimulation of PIP3 accumulation and PHA and AKT phosphorylation is not dependent on actin, and part of it is. And that goes along with there being a direct effect and an actin-mediated positive feedback. Now, on the other hand, here we're doing an experiment in which we have another measure of frontness, RAC-GTP, and what you see is that RAC-GTP is activated, and here we did these multiple times. You're seeing one gel and the results of, I think, four measurements, and so what you see is that RAC-GTP increases, that increase is inhibited when we inhibit PI3 kinase rather nicely, but it actually increases when we turn off the effects of activated Rho. Okay? Now, it doesn't increase in the basal state, but this basal state had the inhibitor of Rho there. But when we turn off Rho and stimulate with the attractant, now we get more RAC, and this is really as an increase over basal, about another fold. It's about twice as much RAC activated as you do in the basal state. That suggests to us that biochemically, if we pretended the cell was a bag, somehow or another, Rho, whose activation is promoted by the attractant, is damping down activation of RAC. Now, in the opposite direction, that's also true. Here is Now we're looking at rho GTP, and attractant stimulates its accumulation, as you might expect. Pertussis toxin blocks only a portion of this, about 25 to 30% of it. The rest is completely resistant. You remember, pertussis toxin completely turns off all the frontness responses, but it leaves a lot of the rho response, and these are the same cells that were assayed. They're not a different day or something. These are the same cells that we just did a different assay on. Now look at the two different inhibitors. This pair here are inhibitors in which are cells in which the cells had PI3 kinase inhibited with a Lilly compound, and in this case, actin polymerization was inhibited by latrunculin B. And what you have in both cases is virtually no effect on the amount of activation seen with attractant, but that same amount essentially is seen even in the absence of attractant. And so that suggests to us that normally there's a basal amount of PIP3 and a basal amount of actin polymerization that is damping down the activation of rho. And that's, again, the idea that these two systems are opposing one another. We can't say at what stage, at what state in these pathways that's occurring, but I think we do think that these things turn one another off. And so in this experiment here that I guess this one just isn't going to want to do it, but you saw that before. The polarity that starts off, you get a couple of one head with a couple of small ones, and then you just get one. What we think is really happening is that the topographical incompatibility of these two kinds of actin assemblies, plus their abilities to turn one another off somewhere in here, and we don't know where, segregates them to different parts of the cell. So there's lots of questions that are raised by this, none of which we can answer, but I want to raise them because you should be, I'm sure you're thinking about them. If all this is right, how do these actin assemblies actually modify the signaling? Why is the front more sensitive? And what is the mechanism that makes that happen? One strong possibility, I think, is that there are accumulations of specific kinds of lipids at the front and the back of cells, and several groups have shown that in neutrophils, that there's lipids that accumulate at the front are those different from those that accumulate at the back. And it might be that, and that's dependent on actin assemblies, but it's also dependent on cholesterol. If you take cholesterol away, that doesn't occur and the cells don't polarize. So it may be that there are lipid rafts that are changing signaling. And furthermore, it's also possible, and this is not actually necessarily separate from the lipid raft idea, that stretch or tension of the cytoskeleton itself changes signaling. There are experiments in which fibroblasts are stretched in one direction, and when that happens, RAC is inactive in the direction of stretch, and the ruffles that would ordinarily occur there are inhibited, and the ruffles occur at the two ends, whereas the membrane that's parallel to the stretch doesn't make any ruffles. Now, my guess is that what's happening there is that myosin is now, that what you've done is you've flattened those actin polymers that are there. Now actin can, myosin can crawl along them. We'll do a little bit of contractility. Maybe there's also a different lipid composition there, and you've inhibited RAC and a sort of a frontness in a gross way in the fibroblasts. So these are possibilities. And then why do the signals bifurcate immediately after the receptor? And here, this is entirely hand-waving. It's clear that in some vague way that would enhance opportunities for fine-tuning and feedbacks and stuff, but the truth is I don't have the faintest idea why biology would have done that other than this vagueness. And I hope modeling folks can help think about that. And another question is there a positive feedback at the back as well? That is, does actin-myosin beget actin-myosin in some way? And we don't have any evidence in that direction. And then, I don't know how much longer I can go on without everybody falling asleep. This is about another 5 minutes or so. Is that okay? Okay. So the question is, what about the compass? I've been talking about polarity and not directionality up to this point. And the question really is, how does a cell in a shallow gradient make such a steep gradient of morphology in the correct direction? Now, what I've told you is that the front of the cell is more sensitive than the back of the cell. So that in some sense, and this is something we touted for a long time as the explanation, in some sense, the cell's perception of the outside has an accentuated sensitivity at the front versus the back. And so if it's in a 2% external gradient, it might be in a 50% internal gradient. And that's fine, I think. It explains perfectly what happens in steep gradients. That is, the mystery of what happens when you move a pipette to the right is simply that you have to have, to get frontness to be in a particular place, you have to keep on stimulating that rapidly decaying actin and PIP3 accumulation. And the front is sensitive, the back is not, and so you get U-turns. That's cool. But I don't think it necessarily explains direction finding in shallow gradients. We thought it did, but Peter and Rick have convinced me that we were whistling Dixie, that isn't the case. And I don't honestly know how we can explain that, and I don't think what you heard from Dan explains it either, to be perfectly honest. What happens is the cells do crawl, and they crawl pretty well, not perfectly, but pretty well, even when the gradient is extremely shallow. And so I wanted to show you that polarity and this compass need not be the same. You saw this movie over here on the left, in which it's really the front of the cell that's following it, and you see very clear demarcation of a back that is fairly static and a front that is quite plastic and can follow it. But if you see this movie that I got from Peter Devriotis, who got from somebody else, I can't remember whom. Gunter Gerisch. What you see when the pipette moves is that you get a front that moves down here, and actually now it will divide into several. And then when the pipette goes back here, it acts like a ROCK-inhibited neutrophil. The back just very rapidly zips on up here. And this movie actually goes on for a very long time and shows the same kinds of things. So this is a cell in which it's able to crawl, it's able to do just fine, but it clearly doesn't have that very, very strong polarization with turnoff of sensitivity at the back that I was describing in neutrophils. I'm told by my Dicti friends that there are developmental stages of Dicti that do show much better polarization that comes to phenotypically resemble that of the neutrophils, but these cells are able to move without it. So the polarity and the strong sense that I've described with neutrophils is not required for direction sensing or crawling. So one clue you've already heard to a possible a direction-finding mechanism or way of accentuating the perceived gradient with CDC42, which was conspicuously missing from everything I described earlier. So these are stained cells, stained for actin or PHAKT, so they're fixed. And what you see here is that instead of the normal polarized cell, here are six different cells that were expressing a dominant negative CDC42, and three cells that were expressing a target of CDC42 that would prevent it from, that would soak up the GTP-bound form of it. So there's two different ways of turning off CDC42, and they both give these extremely bizarre set of morphologies. Sometimes there's multiple fronts, or a very wide front. Sometimes is good actin polymerization in one place, and actually it's in two places here. Sometimes you really have a pretty good front, but they're polymorphous. And if you look at what they do, here's uniform attractant. Here's what happens to four control cells going from 2 minutes to 5 minutes after adding attractant, and they're just the outlines of them. You see each of these is moving in a direction. The cells in which CDC42 is inhibited don't do that. They meander about. They just sort of stick out something here and stick out something here. And if you look at a movie, here's another cell that is exposed to uniform attractant. It's a normal cell, and what you see is it picks a front and just charges off. This cell here has its CDC42 inhibited, and now it's at zero time, it receives attractant uniformly. And what you see is it looks like it's going to do just fine. But then it sort of loses its interest there and suddenly goes back the other way, inexplicably. Here, we thought, well, maybe that's just because there's not a pipette there, that we've got no gradient and it can't choose. Well, here, I've shown you with gradients what happens, so I won't show that one again. This is a case where there's a pipette that stays right here, and there's a cell that has CDC42 inhibited right there, and watch what happens. So here you get these two funny-looking horn-like things pointing in the right direction, but they are unstable, they don't last. And then you'll get one over here in a completely irrelevant direction that goes off here. So our suspicion then is, as yours, as Dan's is that CDC42 is somehow helping to stabilize the position, the permanence and position of a pseudopod, and presumably helping to make it be in the right position in a gradient. But we don't really know how it does that. And it's the idea that it is the compass, I really don't feel like I have seen evidence that says that it is the site of the compass. It's undoubtedly part of something that's necessary for a compass to make the cell steer in the right way. But what the compass is I think we have to say we just plain don't know. And these are the folks who did this. I think I've shown their pictures before. I'm not going to go on to that anymore. But I'll stop there.